Best Western Hotel in Tucson, and I'm going to interview Jerry Kendall. My colleague Skip McAfee is with me. We will be sending a copy of this tape to the Hall of Fame, but Sabre reserves the right to distribute the tape or transcriptions of the interview to other researchers and pass it and post it on the internet. Is that okay with you? You mentioned just a few minutes ago while walking up that you do some sort of class at the University of Arizona.
Yes, I teach a class of elder hostel folks, and normally elder hostel are retired couples that travel around different parts of the country, indeed the world, and take classes of a week's duration that interest them. And my class is Take Me Out to the Ball Game, that's what I entitled it, and it is for the baseball fan. Most everybody in the class, except for some reluctant wives perhaps, or maybe even a reluctant husband, are really into baseball, the history, the legends, the lore, the charm of baseball, and it's a lot of fun for me to teach. I've done this now for 6 years since I retired from the University of Arizona as the head baseball coach.
Is it connected with the University of Arizona?
Yes, the University of Arizona, under contract to the Elder Hostel group internationally, they provide the location, they provide the instructor, and then they share in the responsibility for teaching the folks and giving them a good experience.
Right. Okay. All right, let's get back to you now. Where were you born?
Born in St. Paul, Minnesota, 1935.
Capital.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And did you grow up there?
Yes, I grew up in St. Paul. And I went to the University of Minnesota, and following 3 years at the University of Minnesota, where I played both basketball and baseball, and took a degree in English, then I went into pro baseball.
Okay. Growing up, did you...
Yes.
In what positions?
I've been a shortstop all my life, Dave. I began as a shortstop. I don't know why. I do know why. My father encouraged me to play shortstop because that was the position that had the most demands on a person's skill. I do believe that shortstop, outside of pitching and possibly catching, is the most difficult position to play defensively. So my dad encouraged me that if I could do that, then I could go to other positions as well. So all through high school and college and my first 2 years of pro ball, I was a shortstop. I'd never played anything else.
So I guess your dad had a big influence.
He did, indeed. My dad, Harold Kendall, a railroad man, devoted father, devoted husband. He loved baseball, and he encouraged myself and my two brothers to play baseball along with the other sports. But his dream for his boys was to get the experience of competition and playing high school and college sports if we were able. A chance that he did not have. And, he was a son of Swedish immigrants, and they had to go right to work right out of high school in those days, so he never got a chance to participate, and he wanted that for his boys.
You had other brothers?
Two younger brothers, yes.
In high school, how did your team grow?
We were a good team. I went to Washington High School in St. Paul. It had a storied history of excellence in baseball and football and basketball as well. So I lived in that neighborhood and went to Washington High, and we had the state championship baseball team one of the 4 years that I played, and we're always contending. So it was a good baseball school. I got good training there from my coach, Harry Nelson, and I'm grateful that I had such good teammates, and we were able to compete. And then, of course, in the summers, I played American Legion baseball. And once again, we were on the top team in Minnesota. Two of the 3 years that I played, we won the state championship, we won the regional championship, and advanced on to sectional play in American Legion ball.
During the high school and American Legion ball, any prominent fellows that became major leaguers?
Yes. We played the Fargo, North Dakota American Legion team, and Roger Maris was on that team. We were both only 15 years old at that time. And Roger was the outfielder, and his brother Rudy was the first baseman, and it was a tough game that we played in the regional championship game in, I believe that was in Dickinson, North Dakota, it was held, and so Roger and I played against one another as 15-year-olds. Other players in high school and American Legion that went on to the major leagues. One that I played against in high school, Jack McCart, went on to be a big league goalie for the Rangers. He was the Olympic goalie in 1960 on the gold medal team. American hockey team beat the Russians that year in the finals.
Every 20 years we see
that. Yeah, that's right. And then Jack, who was also a very good baseball player. In fact, we played together at the University of Minnesota. He was our third baseman on the NCAA championship team in 1956. But his professional skills were really great in hockey. That's where he went to make a career.
Now, you mentioned went to the University of Minnesota. I guess you got a scholarship?
I got a basketball scholarship. But I realize now that it was something of an agreement between the basketball coach and the baseball coach. I was a very average basketball player, but I was a good shortstop prospect for Dick Siebert, my coach at the University of Minnesota. So basketball had more scholarships to give out, and so I did play basketball for 3 years, but I was on basketball scholarship that entire time. But it was, I know now, an agreement between the two coaches. I was primarily baseball.
Dick Siebert, was he the former major leader?
Yes, played for Connie Mack in the Philadelphia Athletics. He was all-star first baseman 1 year.
Okay, now how did you get signed to Major League Baseball, professionally?
Well, I signed in 1956, following my junior year at the University of Minnesota. We had won the national championship, College World Series. Ironically, we beat the University of Arizona in the championship game in Omaha, Nebraska. But that was before the draft, and the baseball draft, that is. So everybody was free game, and a number of clubs showed interest in me. But it was also the period of time of the bonus rule. So if a player signed with the big league club for more than $4,000 bonus, then the bonus rule was that he had to go straight to his big league club and play for 2 years before he could be sent to the minor leagues. It was an effort for big league baseball to control spending by the wealthy teams and to buy up the good prospects. And at that time, there were only 16 teams, of course, 8 in either league, National American.
Sounds very familiar.
Yeah, it is. It's an ongoing situation. The Yankees had the money. The Dodgers had the money. The Cardinals had the money. And the other clubs, for the most part, could not afford to do what those other three teams could do. So the rule was instituted to give a fair chance to everybody to sign a good prospect. But what it did, it penalized them with a place on the roster, the 25-man roster. And the Cubs signed me to a bonus contract on June 30th, 1956. And I went right to Chicago and played with the Cubs.
How much was it?
I mean, I sat on the bench with
them. Remember how much it was?
Yes, it was a bonus of $32,000, and then a 3-year contract. Bonus was $32,000, and at that time, the minimum salary in the big leagues was $6,000. So that gave you a total of $50,000.
Now, Sandy Koufax.
A lot of money in those days.
Right. Sandy Koufax was also a bonus. And
yes.
There was a certain amount of resentment that was made on the Dodgers from taking up a spot, of course, and someone would have to leave. Did you run across
the Dodgers? Yes. I should have gone to the minor leagues, there's no question. I was a good college player. I was first team All-American college player, but I wasn't ready to play in the big leagues. I should have gone to A ball, double A ball, and do my apprenticeship. But I was actually a year and a half on the Cubs, and then they rescinded the rule following the 58 season, and I could go. I went to the Texas League and played a year in the Texas League, a year in the American Association, 59, then I came back to the big league last day. But yes, the resentment was there, and we all, that is, we bonus players of that era, we all experienced that because we bumped somebody off the roster. In my case, in Chicago, for the Cubs, it was a fellow named Eddie Winciniak, a very good utility infielder, and very popular among the players. A really good guy. I got to know Eddie later, spring training and so on. But I was not a welcome. There was not any animosity or overt kind of action against me. That wasn't it at all. But there was a measure of resentment. And I was the second of the bonus players on the team.
That's so nice.
The other was, the first one was Don Kaiser, a big right-handed pitcher. And then, about 2 weeks after I signed, the Cubs signed Mo Dorowski.
So there were three?
Yeah, there were three bonus players. Mo was a college player, came from Trinity University in Hartford, Connecticut. And so he joined the team, and we all had to stay. That was three bonus players on the Cubs roster in 56 and 57.
Who was the scout that signed
you? B.D. Himsel. B.D. Himsel went on to become assistant general manager, and he was scouting director at that time. Well, he watched me play, along with some of the other local Midwest scouts. But B.D. came in and watched me play with the Minnesota Gophers, and then he and Whit Matthews, the general manager, came to our home in St. Paul and offered the contract, and I signed.
Now, it's 1956, you're on the Cubs, and Ernie Banks is on the team.
Yes, yes.
Jim Brosnan. was yeah. he his studio, or, you know, he was supposed to be, you know, it's a
Jim rock. Brosnan, Dave, it's Jim. He is one of the most erudite guys I've ever met. He was my roommate. In 56, I had several roommates to begin with, and then finally they settled that Jim had to take me. Jim was a voracious reader, very bright guy, as you know, he became an author, and he still is writing children's books to this day. That is his genre as far as his present occupation. He makes a living as a writer, but he was a delight to room with. Quiet, studious, and a good pitcher. And, I enjoyed very much the year and a half that I was.
And I guess Ernie Banks was the star.
Oh, yes, no question. In 56, when I joined the team, Ernie was the shortstop, of course, Gene Baker, the second baseman, Dee Fondy, the first baseman, Don Hopish, third baseman. And there was no question our star was Ernie Banks. In 55, he'd come off, I believe, an MVP year. I think that he won the MVP in both 55 and 56.
He won 2 years in a row.
For a second division team. Right. So, terrific player, terrific guy.
In 1957, you hit six homers. Your first six homers you hit, three were off Robin Roberts. Did you know that?
Oh, yes.
But mm-hmm. What did you have on him?
I don't know. It was... anomaly, I guess. But in, I love to hit in, at that time, I think they called it Shy Park. Is that right? Was it Shy Park in 56 and 57? Later, it became Connie Mack Stadium. But I had a great background, and I was not a good hitter, let's face it, but I did have some power. And Robin was always around the plate, and he would give me a pitch to get. And I would go deep. And it was just incredible because when I hit that first year, 160, I think.
164,
okay. And I hit the home runs off of Robin. Now later, this is interesting. Maybe it was in 58 or 57, late in the season, 60, when I came back in the National League, Robin was still 50. He became quite a good friend, by the way. And he asked me in the outfield, as we were taking batting practice, he was doing it for me. Anyway, he said, "Why is it that you wear the L?" And I said, "I don't know. I probably called it Mr. Roberts. I don't know." But I said, "You know, I always seem to get a good pitch every time I'm up at the plate." And he had excellent control, you see. And he threw a lot of sliders and a fastball. But I could see his pitches so good. They were all Hall of Fame pitchers. And I was able to see his pitches. Well, he did say in response to my remark that I always seem to get a good pitch. He said, "Well, kid, that'll be the last time you see a good pitch." And after that, it didn't so long.
Right.
Now, when he threw me the slider in the dirt, and then I chased
him. When you came up in 56, Stan Happ was manager, and 57, Bob Shepard put on the fifth. And the team finished seventh. It was the eighth league this year. How did the players feel about that? I mean,
well, Stan Herrick had managed for several years. Now, mind you, I only played half the season in 56. I reported to the team on July 1st. And so I thought Stan was a good manager, but, you know, he was, I think he realized that that would be his last year. And I was just minding my business and doing whatever anybody told me. Fortunately, Yoshi Milano, the clubhouse guy, helped me. He and Doc Schoenemann, the trainer, they kind of watched out for the young college kid. So I just tried to do the right things, and but our team was an eighth place team in 56, and I rather said, you know, we had some great guys on the coaching staff. I thought Stan was a good manager, but he was playing out the screen, so he really went down probably last year. But Pepper Martin was our third base coach. Ray Blades was one of our coaches. Great baseball guy, came from the Ricky tradition, Brad Smith. Our pitching coach was Dutch Lenny.
And
yeah, the pitcher, knuckleball pitcher. So those were all good guys. They were very nice to me and tried to help me. But anyway, then Mr. Wrigley fired Stan and the whole staff. And in 56, Bob Sheffing had coached and managed that. Had managed the Los Angeles Angels, the Pacific Coast League, and they ran away with the Pacific Coast League championship. And they had a bunch of great young pitchers, as well as a really solid lineup. So Mr. Wrigley hired virtually the entire coaching staff, plus most of the players from that 1956. They brought them up there. The players don't contract with much. But they brought up pitchers like Dick Dodd, Bob Anderson. By this time, Mo Drabowski had emerged as a fine young pitcher. And so Bob Sheffield, who was a great manager, really outstanding manager, I thought. He came up with his guys from the Angels and many of the same coaches that helped him out there. And turned it over to Bob Sheffield. And although we finished seventh, we were on the move. We were improving.
Okay. Then next year, you went back. You went down to the minors. That was your first year in the minors. The Texas League. Fort Worth.
58. I went down to the Texas League, and then with the express orders to Lou Pine, the manager for Fort Worth, was to play second base. I was to be the second base. Obviously, I wasn't a decent base on the job. For a year and a half, I served as his caddy, and whenever I got to play, it was because Ernie needed a rest or was injured. So I was fully in agreement with that. I felt that I had to come back to the major leagues and make a contribution, then it was going to be at second base. So for 2 years, I played strictly second base, 58 down in the Texas League, with Fort Worth Cats, and then we moved up to AAA ball, the American Association, in 59.
What was the same team, but
the same Fort Worth team. We won the Texas League pennant in 58 by 13 and a half games. And then that essentially the same team went on to AAA ball in the American Association, and Luke Lyons on there. And I played second base every game for 2 years.
But was it easy to transfer from Fort Worth?
It was. It wasn't easy, Skip, but it was, I had good instruction from Lou Pine, who was the second baseman in the big leagues, before my era, and he gave me good teaching. The only thing I had difficulty with was the double play game, and I finally got that under control, but, you know, it was good experience for me, and then I came back to the big leagues, I was primarily second baseman after that.
Pretty hot down there, wasn't it?
Yeah. Texas League is hot. Very hot.
Okay.
But it was a great season for me, both seasons, 58 and 59, because I was playing every day and playing a good team. In 59, we won our division of the American Association, and we had a three-game playoff with the Minneapolis Millers to see, they were the Northern Division winners, to see who would go to the Little World Series in Havana.
One of the last times you made a little.
Yes, that's right, 1959. And we lost the final game of that playoff, the three-game playoff to the Millers up in what was a brand new stadium at that time in Minneapolis, which became Metropolitan Stadium for the Twins when they moved there from Washington in 1962. But anyway, we lost, you know, in a rain-soaked field, in a rainstorm, to the Millers when they went out to play in the middle of the series. Great experience playing on those two teams because they were pennant winners, championship type caliber, and playing against really good teams. By the way, for that Minneapolis Miller team, one of their players was a young Carl Yastrzemski.
I guess it was still a Boston.
It was a Boston Red Sox player.
Okay, sir. You came up after the latter part of the year, I guess, to Chicago.
Yes. Well, let me think. I came up in 58, I believe, the last 30 days. But I didn't come up in 59 because we were involved in the playoffs.
But 60.
60, yes.
I played 89 games.
Right. In 60, Charlie Grimm was the manager in spring training. And I was a full-time second baseman now. And I played okay in spring training, but Charlie sent me down to Houston at the start of the season. And I went down to AAA ball again, the American Association. This time the Cubs, the AAA farm club is Houston. Marty Marion was the general manager, and Ina Slaughter was the manager of Houston Buffalo. Well, if you remember, rather bizarre thing happened with the Cubs. 2 weeks into the season, Charlie Grimm resigned and Lou Boudreau took the job as manager of the Cubs. They traded places. Lou Boudreau was doing the color analysis for WGN Radio and had been doing it for several years. And they traded places. Mr. Wrigley talked them into that. And Lou Boudreau came down to be the manager and Charlie went up in the press box to do the radio. Well, Lou called me up right away. I think that was maybe 2 weeks into the big league season, something like that. Maybe 2 weeks. But he called me up, and then I played a lot of second base in 1960 for the Cubs.
That sounds as if Wrigley was...
No, as a matter of fact, he wasn't. He seldom came around the ballpark. He seldom was seen, never seen in the ballpark. And seldom around the ballpark. But he was the owner, and he was the winning team. And he made changes reluctantly. That is, he fired managers very reluctantly. He thought that was very unfair to heap all the blame on Stan Van or Al Shepard. And that led to the college of coaches in 1961 and 62, and maybe part of 63, but I don't remember. But I was part of that experiment for the 1961 season.
Kind of come to that, right? Yeah. I want to ask you, at Wrigley Field, how about the fans?
Great fans. I love Wrigley Field. I love the fans. The press was really good. There were three, as I recall, there were three papers that covered the Cubs and the White Sox then. There was the Tribune, of course, and the Chicago American, and the Daily News.
Not the Sun-Times?
Sun-Times. Yeah. Maybe there were four. Yeah, the Sun-Times. Two morning papers, two evening papers. That's right. So there's a lot of attention given to the Cubs and the White Sox. 59, of course, the White Sox won the pennant, so most of the attention went to them. Anyway, I love Wrigley Field and the fans were terrific.
Now, in 60, you played with Ron Santo and Richie Ashburn and Don Zimmer.
Yes, indeed. Don was traded from the Dodgers to the Cubs, and the two of us became good friends. I have a great deal of fondness for Don Zimmer. We were competing for the second base job. And between the two of us, I think that was it. I played 89 games, is that what you said?
Yeah.
In 60? Yeah. And Don probably played the rest.
Right.
At second base. And Ron Santo broke in with the Cubs on Memorial Day of 1960. He was brought up from AA ball, San Antonio, Texas, and put in right in the third base there in Forbes Field in a doubleheader, and he got about 6 hits. I don't know exactly, but he had a great debut. And it's third baseman thereafter.
Now, in 1960, did you become a switch hitter?
Yes.
Explain that.
No, actually,
you only started
in 61.
But That's a pretty unusual. I mean, in the middle of
it, it was very unusual, and it caused some stress in 61. But in 1960, remember, Lou Boudreau had called me up. So Lou was an advocate for me. He liked the way I played defense. And so he was helping me with my hitting. And toward the end of the season, he suggested that I try switch hitting. That was my manager. I thought, my goodness, where has it come to that? Here I am, this is my third year in the big leagues, parts of 3 years, 2 years in minor leagues. And I, you know, I was not a good hitter for average, but I had some power and I could drive in some runs. And I struck out a lot. So he said, why don't you fool around with switch hitting? And at that time, you remember who it was that kind of paved the way in the big leagues to become a late switch hitter? It was Maury Wills with the Dodgers. He didn't become a switch hitter until he was in pro ball and playing in the minor leagues in Spokane. Triple A ball. Anyway, I had pretty good speed, and Lou said, take some swings from the left side of batting practice. So I did in batting practice. The last series of the season against the Dodgers in 60 in the Coliseum out in LA, I batted left-handed against Drysdale and against, I think, Roger Craig. I forget who else it was. I played all three games in that final series, and two of those games were against right-hand pitchers, Drysdale for sure. And although I was 0 for 4, I did have a bunt, sacrifice bunt, and a sacrifice fly. And I hit the ball hard twice and only struck out, I think, twice. I'm trying to make recollect this. But it was enough of an experiment for Lou to encourage me to, during the winter back in St. Paul, and to work on my switch hitting. So I had a lead bat. I strung up a canvas in the basement. Actually, we lived in Minneapolis, and Georgia, and I had two small children. Doug and Betsy, I think. Well, no, we had one, Betsy. Doug was born in January. Hang in there with me. But Doug was born in January of 1960, that's right. And Betsy was 2 years old. So down in the basement, I would hit the ball off of the tee, left-handed, into that canvas that I'd strung up time and time again. I picked up some strength, batting left-handed. The problem with that was, by this time in 1960 and 61, I was pretty mature. I was 25 years old, for goodness sakes. And I didn't have any strength. I didn't have bat speed. Even though I had worked so diligently and lifted weights, swung the heavy bat, I didn't have good bat speed. Anyway, I was encouraged enough in 1961 to go to spring training as a switch hitter. By this time, Lou Boudreau was not the manager. This was the college of coaches. We had, I think, twelve guys?
I have five here, but there may have been more.
Well, I think there were at least eight and maybe even more that all had equal authority in spring training. This was Mr. Brickley's attempt to not blame one person for the team's failures. And so if one guy wasn't doing well as the head coach, you see, the theory was pretty good. It was revolutionary. And it didn't work, but in theory it looked good. So in spring training, everybody had equal authority. Nobody was appointed the head coach. We had eight guys working with us. Rogers Hornsby was one. Buck O'Neill was another. Bobby Adams, Lou Klein, Grady Hatton, V.D. Hemsel, Elvin Taffy. Those I remember. And they have been Harry Kraft.
Harry Kraft.
Harry Kraft was another. Yeah. So it was only... Now, in spring training, I was batting in the exhibition games, and I was getting some hits. I was doing okay.
Maybe as a switch hitter.
As a switch hitter, yeah. I was batting right-handed against lefties and left-handed against right-handed pitchers. And I was getting some hits. I was really encouraged. And the college of coaches, the eight or however many, called me over to the Maricopa Inn one day after practice, after a game. And they said, this was a high-level conference. There was no head coach. There was no one man in charge. But it was a consensus that I could help the team more by being strictly a right-handed hitter. Because I could go deep now and then. And I was a good fielder. And the jet stream in Wrigley Field is out the left center. Well, that's what the reasons they gave me. Now, I was sitting there in kind of a circle. These guys were all around the semicircle. You know? And they said, we don't want you to switch it. I protested. I said, no, I think I can do this. It really will help my career, and I think it will help the ball club. And I tried to stand fast that I wanted to be a switch hitter. And they said, well, okay, Jerry, you can do it in the morning. And that ended the conversation. And I forsook switch hitting. And in 61, I had a pretty good year, hitting all right-handed. So that was my experiment, brief as it was, with switch hitting.
In 61, you played with Billy Williams.
Yeah, Billy Williams was in there.
I guess I don't know if it was that year, but it may have been the year he started his own consecutive game streak.
It might have been, Dave. I'm not sure. But what a great player, and once again, a great person. One of those unassuming, hardworking stars.
Now, you've been playing for the Cubs all your career up to this point, and then in 1962, you were traded to Cleveland.
Yes.
Was that in the off season?
Yes. That was an interesting episode. I had a pretty good year. What did I hit in 1961?
In 61, you hit 242.
Okay. 242, but I had some home runs. And
some
RBIs.
Nine homers and 44 RBIs.
Okay.
In 96 games.
It wasn't a bad year, and I figured that that I was ready, and I was on the threshold, that maybe I could really make a significant contribution to the Cubs, playing all second base. So at the end of the year, I was told by the College of Coaches again that we're going to move Ernie to first base, and you're going back to shortstop. And that was in the papers. It wasn't just an agreement between my bosses and a player, myself. It was in the Sporting News. It was in the Chicago papers. I was excited. I was really pleased. Shortstop was where I really felt more at home than anything. All my career up through that time, I went to the minor league. So I was really excited. In November, I was a graduate student at the university, going after my master's degree at Minnesota. And whatever the November date, 20th or whatever, I came home from school, and my wife Georgia said, "You have a long distance call from Gabe Paul." In Cleveland.
Did you have a hit with that?
I thought, no, this can't be. I knew who Gabe Paul was. He's the general manager at Cleveland. But I thought, what is happening? And just then, I got a call from the Cubs. And I forget, frankly, who it was. And they said, "Jerry, we've made a trade for you. We need pitching, and Cleveland needs a regular second baseman, and we've made a trade. You're going to Cleveland for Bobby Locke, a right-handed pitcher." I called Cleveland, returned the call to Gabe Paul, and that was all confirmed. I was quite disappointed. You know, I love the Cubs. I broke in with the Cubs. I've been with the Cubs now for 6 years, including 2 years in minor leagues. So I was a National League guy. I grew up in St. Paul, where the Dodgers had their minor league club, St. Paul Saints. Minneapolis had the New York Giants farm club. I was a National League guy. So, but obviously I was in the dispute that I was going. That was before free agency. And you know, that was a real breakthrough for me. I played every game in 1962.
154 games, right?
Yeah. I missed several games. I think we had a season of 158 games then. It was the expansion year.
Oh, 162.
162, was it? Okay. Well, I missed those games. I missed because of my mother's funeral. 68 games? Did I miss that many?
Played 154.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because that was the old number.
Yeah.
And then,
well, I didn't realize we missed that many. But the only games,
a few rainouts,
the only games I didn't start was when I went home from my mother's funeral. Back to St. Paul. So that's when I had a breakthrough, I thought, and I had a pretty good year. And I started every game.
Who was the shortstop?
Woody Held. Woody Held was the shortstop. We had a good team. We moved into first place in late June with a four-game sweep over the Yankees. And we held on to first place until shortly before the All-Star game. And then our bullpen failed us. But
finished sixth.
Yeah, we went really down. But we had a bunch of good players. Woody Held was an outstanding player. Don Romano behind the plate. Dick Donovan won 20 games. He was my roommate in Cleveland. And great guy again.
And Pete Ramos was on the team.
Pedro was there. Yeah, and
Mudcat Grant.
Mudcat, great pitcher. Jim Perry.
And Sam McDowell.
And
was his first
Sudden
year.
Sam, yeah. He broke in with a flourish. So we had that run at it, and then we ran out of gas, I guess. But in my case, my personal case, it was my best year in the leagues, where I played a lot and did pretty well.
I got a question. Mel Magaha was the manager, but Mel Harder managed the last two games and won them both. I mean, he was the winning manager. I was wondering,
yeah.
How did he get it?
Mel had been fired. Mel McGahey had been fired. Yeah, Mel McGahey, it was his only year manager. Well, maybe he went on to Kansas City. I'm trying to remember. It was his first year managing, and he did pretty well up to midpoint of the season, and then things went bad. And he was fired, and Mel Harder, interim.
Was he the coach? A coach?
Yeah, he was the pitching coach at that time. And George Strickland, the third base coach. Well, then, that winter, gave Paul hired 30 tenants.
Harder just died.
Yeah. He was quite old. Quite old, but I never saw him pitch. He was a great pitcher. I thought he was a very good pitching coach.
How did the American League differ from the National League? Did you see any significant difference?
No, I didn't. The word was, or the conventional wisdom, was that National League was fastball league and American League was breaking ball league. But no, I didn't see that. As far as pitching to me, they all pitch the same way, just high heat and then swing and miss. Or swing at a curve in the third.
63, of course, you mentioned Bertie Tebbets took over.
Mm-hmm.
And the team finished fifth, a little bit better.
Yeah. Bertie was an established, successful manager. He had managed for Gabe Paul at Cincinnati. And he had managed the Milwaukee Braves. So he had been around. He was an experienced baseball guy and a very astute manager. And Gabe hired his previous manager, his friend, Gabe hired Bertie Tebbets.
In 64, you started with Cleveland, but then later you were traded to Minnesota, your hometown.
Yeah.
Who were you traded for?
I was traded, it was a three-way trade on June 14th, the day before the deadline of 64, it was a three-way trade. Let's see, how did it go? The Angels, the Indians, and the Twins. Vic Power went from the Twins to the Angels. I went from the Indians to the Twins, and Billy Moran, a second baseman, went from the Angels to the Indians. Did I get that right?
Right.
It was a three-corner trade. And Power, Billy Moran, and Jerry Kendall.
You mentioned Vic Power. I'm not an expert, but he was the best fielding first baseman I ever saw.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was very, very good. He was had the highest fielding average year after year. He was very, he did it with a flourish, too. And Vic was an outstanding player. Now, modern day, you haven't asked me this, I'm just going to volunteer. But today, the best fielding first baseman in the National League is J.T. Snow. Pretty much acknowledged around the league by coaches. And in the American League, I say J.T. Snow because he played for me here at the University of Arizona. So there you go.
We'll get to that.
A little parenthetical.
Okay.
Comment.
Okay, now, so in 64, the team finished tied for sixth with Cleveland.
Is that right? I'd forgotten that. But, yeah.
And Camilo Pascual was on that team, and Jim Cott,
Mudcat
Grant again.
That's right. Mudcat was traded shortly after I was. And Jim Perry was traded also from the Indians to the Twins during this period. So there were three of we Indians, former Indians, that were on the Twins in late 64 and all of 65. So that team, the 64 Twins, was a team in waiting.
Right. They made it next year.
Well, we did. We won the pennant
65
quite easily.
Right.
But the filled with big league stars.
And you had Zorro Vasalles?
MVP in 1965.
Tony Oliva?
Tony Oliva.
Armin Killebrew?
Bob Allison.
Earl Batty had, Bob Allison, great left fielder. Earl Batty was a great catcher. We had...
they all played for Washington, my team.
Oh, well, that's why you zero in on those names. Sure, they were all signed. Those Cubans were signed by Papa Joe Cambria. And Calvin Griffith, not Calvin, but Clark. Yeah. Clark signed them, and then Calvin inherited them and brought them to Minnesota. And boy, were they great. Zoe Versailles was the MVP in 1965. And I played a lot of second base in 65. I kind of split it with Bernie Allen.
You played 125 games. Well, yeah. At least in the infield you played a little short.
I started at second base a lot, and then I was utility after that, and I could play short and third too. But so I was up close and personal with Zoe Versailles and playing alongside of him. And we lockered together. So I saw a great, great performance. He hit 20-some home runs. He drove in like 75 runs.
He was a leadoff hitter, wasn't he?
He was a leadoff hitter, hit second sometimes. But he was up there in the top of the order and drove in, if not 75, it was in the 60s, a lot for a leadoff man, and played shortstop like he invented it. He was just amazing. And in that team, Harmon Killebrew and the names you mentioned, Bob Jimmy Hall, Don Minchin, Earl Batty, he was MVP. Jim Cott on the mound, Mudcat Grant, Camilo Pasquale, Jim Perry. The key pitcher, however, was Al Worthington. Al Worthington coming out of the bullpen. We don't have his statistics in front of him, but he, night after night, would shut the door. It was before the time of the closer, specifically, a couple outs in the ninth, never more than three outs. Al would come in the seventh, and he'd pitch and close the door. And he'd do it two nights later. Pitched a lot of innings, and he was a key pitcher to win the pennant.
How was the pennant race? Was it close, or?
No. Forget who we were contending with, but we clinched it in Washington with about a week to go at RFK Stadium. On Sunday afternoon, we finished the pennant. I know we went down to Baltimore. That was a Sunday, so we played one more week, one full week, as the American League champions.
Okay, now in the next of the World Series, did you play in the World Series?
No.
Were you injured? Or?
I was injured, but I was injured late in the season. I was wiped out at second base in Comiskey Park two successive nights by Tom McCraw, on double play, who played second base. Tom McCraw got me with a good, clean, hard slide. I'm not saying they were vicious. And then the other one, I believe, was Lou Scotland. Got me. But on two consecutive nights, I was wiped out of second base. And the second time, I tore a muscle in my left leg up under the cheek. And I couldn't hardly walk. So it didn't go on the disabled list. But I was under treatment. And they brought up Frank Willison, because Bernie Allen had bad knee. And Frank had been playing down in Denver, the farm club, under, Billy Martin had managed in Denver, but he was third base coach now with the Twins in 65. But Frank came up to play second base and did so well. As I was recovering from my injury, there was no reason to take Frank out.
And so you could have played.
I could have played in the World Series. I was out of the lineup. I couldn't have played for a period of about 3 weeks. But then I got well, and I served a utility role. And by the time the World Series came around, I was perfectly healthy. But Frank played every inning in the World Series. So I didn't get to play, but I up and down the dugouts, with my bat over my shoulder, trying to convince Sam Healy to give me a shot.
Now, that series went to seven games. Remember that seven
games?
Sure.
Series.
It was Kopax and Cotton.
Yeah, Mudcat had won game six. Mudcat ran. That was interesting because we won the first two games in Metropolitan Stadium. And we beat Drysdale. He pitched the first game because the first game was a Jewish holiday at Sandy Koufax.
Yom Kippur, that was the
thing. Yom Kippur. And so Sandy didn't even come to the ballpark. But we beat Drysdale and we beat Koufax the next day. I believe that's how it went. So now we have a two-game 2-0 lead. We go out to L.A. and we lose three games. Three straight games.
Home court advantage.
And we come back for game six. This is something perhaps not well known. I don't know if it ever reached I think it did reach the papers. But anyway, the Dodgers came to the ballpark with their bags packed. for game six. Checked out of the hotel, brought their luggage, figuring they were going to board the plane to go home after winning game six. And Mudcat Grant got wind of that in the clubhouse. He was pitching. And he got so fired up, and so did some of the other players around him. You know, that, you don't do that. You don't rack the bats before the last out. So Mudcat pitched a terrific game, also hit a three-run homer, and we win game six. Send it back to the hotel. And game seven, Kopax is on the mound, and he was just magnificent. He threw almost all fastballs. We knew it was coming. And Junior Gilliam made a great play, shot down the third base line with two outs and two men on. I think the score was 4-1.
Well, I was going to say 2-0.
Well, we were within three runs, at the tying run of the plate. We were behind, rather, to Kopax in the late innings, like the seventh or eighth. They were had tying run up the plate. And the two outs, and I think it was Zoya Versailles, had shot down third base, the baseline, and Junior Gilliam made a terrific stop. Scrambled his feet, tagged third base for the third out, force out. And then Sandy Kopax just threw us away. But that was a turning point for the game, because had that ball gotten by and two runs had scored, and the tying run would have been on second. Now, you'll have to check the box score on this and see exactly what the score was and what inning. I don't remember, but I do remember the great play by Gilliam. I remember the great pitching by Kopax, and they won the World Series.
Anything about Kobe?
One of the great gentlemen of the game?
Yeah, laid back there.
I'm sorry?
He was sort of laid back. And very.
Yeah, he was quiet, the quiet killer. That was his nickname, Killer Kilgore. But he was a gentle person, but a hard, determined player. And a home run, he's in the Hall of Fame. I don't have to sing his praises. We all know he's a great player, but he's also a great gentleman. And during the 65 season, he was on the disabled list. It was a horrible injury at first base. He was playing first base against Baltimore. And I believe this was in Metropolitan Stadium. I remember the play at first base very well, and I'm not sure if it was in Baltimore or in Minnesota. But Richie Rollins, who played great third base for us that year, fielded a ground ball hit by Russ Snyder. And Russ Snyder was a left-handed hitter, and he could run really well. Kind of sliced the ball down third base. And Richie made the play and threw over to Harmon covering first, and threw a single. And the ball sunk into the baseline, and Harmon reached with an extended arm for the ball, just as Russ Snyder ran into his extended left arm, dislocated his elbow. Horrible injury. And he was out in terrible pain, and the doctors and everybody thought he was out for the rest of the season. He had that injury. But typical of Harmon, he went right to work on rehabilitation and playing through pain, and he got himself ready for the last, whatever, 2 weeks of the season, and played in the World Series. So I can't hardly finish with just a word about him. How would you like about 12 paragraphs? I'm one of his great fans. He's a great guy. Lives up here in Wisconsin.
Now, that was your last year in the majors.
My last full year, I went to spring training with the Twins in 66. And I thought I was going to stick. I didn't hit well in 65. I think I hit 196, which is hardly assures me of a job. But I was healthy by this time and went to spring training and was doing okay. And just at the end of spring training, was playing a lot of second base, was living time with Quillacy. Bernie Allen, by this time his knee was such that he couldn't play any longer, as I remember. And Cesar Tovar was on our team, and he was also a second baseman.
So there was a lot of competition, but I felt like I was doing all right. But then Calvin Griffith made a trade for Chuck Schilling. Remember Chuck? Second baseman with the Red Sox. A good player. And the Red Sox needed a left-handed pitcher. Calvin thought he needed a better second baseman. So he made the trade, called me into the office in Orlando, and said, I've made a trade. I'm releasing you. Which, in a way, I could have gone back to the minor leagues. He could have tried to convince me of that. But he felt like I wouldn't do that after nearly 8 years of big leagues. And I had four small children.
You were about 30.
And 60, I was 31. So I felt I still could play. But he released me and it allowed me to try to make a deal for myself. So that was good of him, rather than say I'm sending you down to Denver, I guess. Yeah. And I tried to hook on. I was disappointed. I couldn't argue with Calvin because I had hit so poor the year before. But I was very disappointed. It felt like a play. I made three calls to three clubs to see if I could hook on with them. But it was right at the cutdown date. At that time, you cut down to 28 before opening day. And people were cutting down to that figure. And I talked to Gabe Paul in Cleveland, and he said, Jerry, some other years I could use you right now where roster is full with Indians. I called the Chicago White Sox to see if they could use me. And I called the Calgary, but none of them had room for a second baseman. And so I closed the door on my professional career there. Disappointed, but sure was grateful for the time that I had spent.
Well, let me ask you, when you went to the American League, did you try to do any more switch hitting?
No.
Okay, so what did you do next?
Well, I needed a job. In 1966, when you were released, you didn't get severance pay. You got a plane ticket home. And that was very nice. The Twins, they gave me my suitcase with number 16 on it. But that's all you got. Now, if you're released at certain points of spring training, you get half your salary or a quarter of your salary, a portion of it anyway. But that was long before. That nice perk. So I needed a job. I went back to Minnesota. I had four small children, Georgia, my wife, and I. We had a home in Minneapolis. And I wanted to coach. I've always wanted to coach. And the University of Minnesota offered me a job as assistant basketball coach. I had been coaching the freshman basketball team at the university for two seasons before that, two winter seasons, because I was going to school anyway. And
was that a non-paying job?
Non-paying job. And I did it for John Cunha, the coach at Minnesota at that time.
Wasn't he the one that
used to
have the Minneapolis
Lakers? Yeah, he won five championships. That's right. Five NBA championships with the Minneapolis Lakers. Well, then when the Lakers moved to L.A., John Cunha stayed in Minnesota, and he eventually became the head coach at the University of Minnesota. And so he invited me back on his staff, full-time now, as assistant coach. So I got the job assistant basketball coach, and then I did a lot of other things with the athletic department. I was a fundraiser, and I taught some classes. And but I really wanted to coach baseball. 2 years later, I was offered the assistant baseball job, too, under Dick Siebert, for whom I played.
And he was still there.
Still there, and still my hero. I learned all my baseball from Dick. Truly, I did things just like Dick Siebert did them when I came down here to coach in Arizona. So there was a change in assistant coaches there, and so I did both for 1 year, assistant basketball coach and assistant baseball coach, and that was an impossible job. Because by that time, Bill Fitch was the head basketball coach, and he had two assistants, myself and George Hansen, and I was strictly part-time.
He hadn't coached the Celtics?
No. The Cavaliers, he came from the University of North Dakota. No, I take it back. He came from Bowling Green. He had been at North Dakota and done very well, and had Phil Jackson as his center. And then he went to Bowling Green to step up in basketball coaching, and from there he came to the University of Minnesota. Well, he tolerated that for 1 year, a part-time assistant coach. And believe me, I just wore myself out doing both. I was scouting basketball, assistant coach on the bench. I'd be running over at the basketball practice to the field house. And Dick Siebert only had one assistant, myself. So at the end of that year, Bill Fitch said, look, I need a full-time assistant in basketball. So then the athletic director, Marsh Ryman, made me full-time assistant baseball coach. He gave me some other duties in the department. That's where I was until I came down to the University of Arizona in 1972.
How did that open up?
Well, that was interesting too. Mind you, I had trained in Arizona for 8 of my 10 years in pro baseball. 6 years with the Cubs and 2 years with the Cleveland Indians, right here in Tucson. I loved Tucson, and my wife, Georgia, loved Tucson and all of Arizona. Well, here I am, assistant baseball coach under Dick Siebert. I'm the heir apparent to Dick when he decides to retire, but he's still going strong. And I get a call from my brother, who was teaching and coaching high school basketball in Phoenix. He said, Jerry, Frank Sanford has just retired. He's announced that 1972 will be his last year of coaching, and they're looking for a coach. They're taking applications. This was August of 71. So I went to Dick Siebert, and I said, Dick, what do you think? That's one of the great college coaching guys in the country. And Frank Sanchez, my predecessor, had done a remarkable job of building the program into a nationally known baseball program. So I'd like to apply, Dick. What do you think? He said, Jerry, if it was me, and I was a candidate for that job, and they hired me, I wouldn't even stop to pick up my laundry. That's what he said. He said, I hate to lose you. He was very kind. He said, it's like losing my right arm. But I will support you if you want to go out there. Well, knowing that Dick still was active in his coaching, we didn't know when he'd retire. He didn't know when he'd retire. I applied for the job and interviewed for it. And Dick was very helpful, along with Gabe Paul and others in professional baseball, whom I knew, Bing Devine. And it came down, this is interesting, discovered this all later after I was, they really wanted Bobby Richardson to come down and coach.
Because he's from South Carolina.
Yeah. And Bobby had retired from the Yankees at that time, and he was coaching the University of South Carolina. He had coached the University of South Carolina, then he resigned that to run for Congress in South Carolina. Well, they really wanted Bobby. And he said, no, I'm not interested. Give us a couple names. And Bobby gave them my name and Steve Hamilton, who was the left-handed pitcher with the Yankees and the teammate of Bobby. Yeah, big tall fellow, one of few players who played both professional basketball and baseball at the same time. He played with me at the Clippers. Well, anyway, Steve was from Kentucky and a good friend of Bobby's, and Bobby and I were good friends. He said, you could take either one of those guys, and they would be good coaches for you. Well, there was a long list of candidates and a long list of people who interviewed besides Steve and myself, but it came down. They wanted a person with big league experience. The athletic director here in Arizona was Dick Clawson, the late Dick Clawson. And he had decided that in order to have a good relationship with pro ball, with the scouts, to help build the program. See, Bobby Winkles had done this up at ASU. He had a great relationship with the scouts and with the front offices, and he was being recommended by them to go to ASU. Rick Mendon, Sal Bander, Reggie Jackson, all of these guys played for Bobby Winkle. So Dick Clawson thought, well, I'm going to try to get somebody with big league experience. And so both Steve and I had it. And I believe to this day, nobody was verified this, but I believe that I was his. And he called me an officer. So that's my...
Wait, what year was that?
That was December of 1971. He said, I'd like you to come down and full salary as the coach in waiting on February 1st, 1972. Frank is still the coach, Frank Sanchez. If you watch his team, see who you want to keep, see what improvements you could make, where the strengthening has to be done, and then use the whole spring for recruiting. Well, it was a perfect transition for a coach because I could be out while other college coaches are coaching their team and teaching classes although I did teach classes by the end during that semester. But I could be out recruiting. And I spent all spring recruiting and watching the team that I was inheriting. And that's how I became coach. 1973 was my actual first year of coaching. But I had been there for a full year leading up to that.
And how many years did you coach?
I coached 24 years.
Wow.
And you add that year in waiting, it's 25. So I had some tremendous players.
Did you name some of these players?
I'm proud to do it. I mean, the paternal pride. But in spite of their coach, they won a lot of ball games. Guys like Ron Hansen, Dave Stegman, Craig Lefferts in those early years, made it to the big leagues. Did I say Dave Stegman?
Yeah.
Okay. Greg Barger, they all played in the big leagues. And then as we moved into more recent years, Scott Erickson, J.P. Snow, Trevor Hoffman. I'm missing some, and it's a shame because there were, I think, off of those teams that I coached, there were something like 20 guys that were in there. And some of them for a long, long time, like that. And Terry Francona, very player of the year in college baseball in 1980. And he played here for us. Was one of the two best players I ever coached. The other was Dave Stegman. When I say best, I'm not diminishing the others I've mentioned, but about five tool players. The scouts now are looking for five tool players. That's run, throw, hit, hit with power, and speed.
Field.
Run, throw, hit, hit with power, and field. And those guys have it. Terry Francona, they're terrific college players. And guys like Ron Hansen. Ron Hansen was one of my first recruits here in Tucson, and he was a third baseman. He was an All-American third baseman in 1974, my second year. And we had a terrific team. We didn't win the national championship, but we were 58-6. And we got bumped off in the regional playoffs. But Ron Hansen was All-American third baseman. And as a junior, he played third base and was, again, a great year. And then we needed a catcher for 1976. We had a great team coming back, but we had no catcher. And we convinced Ron, who had been nothing but a shortstop and third baseman, to try to go behind the plate. And he resisted that. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to play pro ball, but he thought he was an infield guy. And he could probably play up there, but he was slow at play. Well, he agreed to it, and my associate coach, Jim Wayne, was our pitching catching coach, and he took Ron Hansen and molded him into a big league catcher for 13 years. And not only that, he was our key player in 1976 when we won our first national championship. And we wouldn't have done it without Ron Hansen behind the plate.
You enjoyed recruiting going out?
I didn't mind it. As many coaches say, they despise recruiting. I kind of enjoyed it because I had a great product to offer, the University of Arizona. The education here, the distinguished university, and the baseball program. So, the guys we recruited, they came and they played well, and they've been a real reason we had such a successful program.
How many times did you go to the U.S.?
We went to
the College World Series.
The College World Series. We went there five times, and we won it two times. We won it in 1976 with Ron Hassey, Dave Stegman, Steve Powers. We won it in 1980 with Terry Francona, Craig Lefferts, Casey Candell, Greg Barger. Those guys are all made the big leagues. And we won it again in 1986 with, oh my goodness, members failing in 1986. Candy players. Tommy Hinzo, Dave Rohde, Steve Strong, first baseman Todd Trapton, third baseman Chip Hale. Chip Hale made it to the big leagues with the Twins. And Chip was one of the really great players I've ever had here. an excellent student, straight A student, 4-year starter, played 4.5 years with the Twins this year. He's now one of the up and coming stars in the Diamondback organization. He is the director of minor league infield play. He managed at El Paso last year, and watch for Chip Hale. He's a big league coach someday, and I think someday he'll be good for
anything. Yeah, Ancona was a manager too.
Yes, he managed 3 years for the Phillies. 1997, 98.
So, after that, you wrote a couple of books.
Yes, I wrote a book in 1983 for Sports Illustrated called Sports Illustrated Baseball. It's a coaching manual. And it's still on the shelves.
For all levels of pitching?
Yeah, primarily for college on down. It's a position-by-position manual accompanied by great pictures, because the Sports Illustrated photographers that came down to shoot the pictures were, the experts in the field. And the script is not bad. But I've written a lot of articles. But then, most recently, I'm co-editor of the book, The Baseball Coaching Bible. 27 of the legends of college coaching, primarily, who most of us are retired, but who wrote a chapter in the book. Each of us wrote a chapter of what we thought was most important in our college coaching. Guys like Rod Dato, Ron Fraser, Bobo Braden up at Washington State, John Lincoln at Miami, Maine, Bobby Winkles. It's a great coaching inspiration. What it is, it's the legacy left by these 27 coaches to the next generation, what they think is important in coaching. So it's pretty good.
It's in order to teach classes, you mentioned
Well, yes, I have an education, a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Minnesota.
But in teaching?
I have a master's degree in physical education, also from Minnesota. So, yes, when you teach at a college level, you should, they desire to have at least a bachelor's degree, and hopefully an advanced degree. So my teaching here at the University of Arizona is all in the physical education department. I didn't teach college English. I taught high school English.
Can you comment about the colleges serving as a training ground for the business?
It's for a player, a young player coming out of high school, who is motivated to go to college and has the native ability to do that. I think there's no question he should go to college before signing, unless he is one of those high draft choices that gets 7-figure contract. LeBron James, but I'm thinking more of guys like Alex Rodriguez coming out of Miami. What was his high school? We tried to recruit A-Rod. Came out here for a visit. But he got a huge contract from Seattle. And you can't ask a kid to pass that kind of thing up. But if you're just going to get a moderate sum to sign and forego college and the chance for an education, I don't think that's wise. So I'm an advocate of going to college first and using that as preparatory ground. You look at the draft every year. The first 4 or 5 rounds are generally college players, mostly college players. They're going to invest a lot of money in this player. And if they do that, they want to have a guy with some maturity, some awareness, along with the increased physical skills and strength. And when you play in a tough college conference like the Pac-10, like the Southeast Conference, all right, you can go all over. The major Division I conferences now, you get 64 teams playing in the playoffs to go to see who goes to the College World Series. And that is excellent competition. You're seeing good pitching. You're talking about guys like Mark McGwire, Randy Johnson, playing college ball, Barry Larkin, Jason Giambi, Mike Piscina, Terry Francona, Trevor Hoffman, Dodd Erickson from Arizona here. Barry Bonner. Well, when they made a quick trip to the big leagues. Some of them didn't even, Dave Winfield never played a day in the minor leagues. He was at the University of Minnesota for 4 years. And he signed with the Padres, went right to the big leagues. So you see the advancement and the investment on the payoff rather, the dividend on the investment is much quicker for the college players. So the big leagues are recognizing that, and they scout the colleges with fine tooth comb. Scrutinize it very carefully. Is this guy worth that kind of money? Yes, he is. He'll be a help in the big leagues in 1 or 2 years. Whereas a high school player, you know where they fail mostly? And any big league scouting director will tell you this. A high school kid doesn't fail because he lacks the ability. It's maturity. He was a 17, 18-year-old kid away from home for the first time. He has some money in his pocket. It's maturity. They just simply can't handle the challenge of the adult world in a dog-eat-dog profession. This is tough. Wait, it's a tough place to keep a job. It's in professional baseball. So I'm an advocate, and now I'm sounding like the college coach I am, but I'm an advocate of going to school first, unless there are extenuating circumstances like a huge contract, a windfall kind of thing, or they're simply not motivated to go to school. At home they're not motivated, or in their mind and heart they're not motivated.
It seems as if the Hispanic invasion and the Asian invasion is going to overwhelm the baseball.
I don't know that we're overwhelming yet, but there's a significant number, and it increases every year, of non-American players. For years and years coming from a lot of countries in Latin America, and good players, obviously, great players. But now you introduce the Japanese, the Asians, the Australians, Taiwan. You know, there are players that have come from the Netherlands to play in the big leagues. Aruba, that's what he says. And this is growing. Baseball is truly an international game. And it's growing thanks to Major League Baseball here and the commissioner's office. Do you know how many countries have a national baseball program? Do you have any idea? Have a national baseball program where they're competing internationally.
Over 100.
Over 100. 111. All the way from Osaka town, and a bunch of calories for us.
Yeah, but they think they've taken it away from the Olympics now.
Okay. I mean, we have to make some modifications with the Olympics, and the United States Olympic Committee and Major League Baseball, together with USA Baseball, our national baseball program, they're going to make those modifications. Baseball is a global game. I don't think it's, well, I hope it's another thing.
Arizona, what's your typical attendance?
Well, right now, baseball is not drawing very well. In the last several years that I've coached, it didn't draw very well. The major reason is we haven't advanced to the College World Series for a while. Our last visit to the College World Series was 1986 when we won it. We've been a strong team in 89 and again in 93, but we didn't get to Omaha. And also because basketball has just taken off under Coach Lee Rose. And you know that our season here in Arizona, our baseball season and basketball season overlap for like 2.5 months. If they get to the playoffs, the Final Four. So the interest is so keen and deservedly so. Luke is a terrific coach. He's just turned his community upside down with his success. And he's maybe. Well, I say this, because I know him, and he's a former neighbor here in Arizona, and was a good friend, but I think he may be the best coach I've ever seen. Certainly in basketball. So, the reason that baseball interest is not up here, but back when we were winning in the mid and early 80s and in the 70s, we would draw, and there were several years we had average attendance of 3,500, and peak attendance of over 10,000 for our games at Arizona State.
That's a big round,
yeah. But we haven't met with much success in the last 10 years. since 93, as a matter of fact. We had a real good team. We contended for the, we lost in the ninth inning of the regional final for Oklahoma State, and I would have gone back to Omaha. But don't get me started on that. That was a bad pitch to a good hitter. But and then in the meantime, Lute Olson was had such a great basketball program.
Who's the coach down there?
Andy Lopez. My successor was my longtime assistant, Jerry Stitt. He was 18 years as my assistant coach. And when I retired after the 96 season, it was right that he get the job. He was ready for it. However, he didn't do as well as the athletic director thought he should, and was fired 2 years ago, after 5 years. And then Jim Leibengood, our athletic director, went to Florida to get Andy Lopez. He's the West Coast guy. Coached at Pepperdine and then University of Florida. And now he's the coach. He's in his second year. He's a good coach.
Skip, you have a few questions.
I don't know if you've seen this book, Baseball Dictionary.
No.
But I'm the editor of it. We're working on the third edition. And I just had a couple of pitching terms that I don't understand. I don't know if you would know.
Maybe
that.
I can help you.
But are you finished?
Yes, go ahead.
You want to keep it on?
It's on.
When you say a pitcher is nasty, what does that really mean?
He's very good. Very good. It doesn't mean that he's necessarily a head over.
Right.
That he has nasty stuff. That's a compliment.
But it means?
I mean, it's out of the ordinary. When a hitter ascribes the term nasty to a pitcher, we're talking Bob Gibson, John Drysdale, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and
I know
today,
that.
Randy Johnson, Chris Schilling. It's not a not a derogatory term.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out they talk about a tight spin on a pitch. What does that mean?
You can't pick up the rotation. Tight spin is normally a slider rather than a curveball. Slider has good velocity to it, and it's rotating this way. See, fastball, like a Sandy Koufax would throw, rotates this way, like so. A slider rotates this way, spin of the ball. The four long seams on the ball, four long seams are what determines the rotation. Then there are the short curve seams, there are four of those also that can picture the ball. Well, if you can get the long seams rotating this way, that's a tight spin, and that's a slider, a good, hard, sharp slider.
So a tight spin means the ball goes faster?
No, it doesn't go faster, but it slides. It breaks quickly away from you.
Breaks
or into you, depending on which side of place you're on. That's a tight spin.
When they talk about the arm angle for a pitcher and the arm slot, those are different things, right?
Different. Well, the arm angle.
I've seen the term come up now a lot recently.
And that might be a good description. The slot. The arm slot is where that ball is released. Now, Sandy Koufax would release it up here. That's his arm slot. It's right over the top. Bob Gibson would release it out here. His arm slot is out here.
So it's where the arm is when the ball is released?
Tom Seaver releases it with a three-quarter motion right here. So we've got, that's where the ball is released, where the pitcher, I mean the hitter, looks for the slot, where the arm is coming through the ball release.
Now, isn't that the same as the release point?
No. Yes and no, Brian. I'm no expert pitcher. So the release point, yes. The arm slot picks up the arm coming through.